Aloha, I'm Beverly Deep Keever, 87 years old. Today's date is June 17th, 2022. We're at HPR Studio in Honolulu, Hawaii. I'm here with Dr. Ann Allman, my dear friend for many years and teaching colleague.
Aloha, I'm Ann Allman. I'm 67 years old. It's June 17th, 2022, and I'm in the Hawaii Public Radio studio in Honolulu, Hawaii, with my friend, Dr. Beverly Keever. Bev, I've known you for 30 years. We've been friends.
Yes.
And we taught together for 17 years, and honestly, you are my hero. And I always look to you as like the moral compass of our department, university, and also for your incredible knowledge, your investigative skills in journalism, and going to Vietnam for 7 years. So you are the role model for our students and our go-to person. And so that's why I'd love to ask you more about your time in Vietnam. And we've had many adventures together, the two of us, but I've done nothing like that in my life, go to a war zone. But you and I went to China together, and I remember when we were walking on the Great Wall together, and you walked right up to a Vietnamese woman. Somehow you knew she was Vietnamese, and you got out your notebook, and you started taking notes and talking to her. I got a photo of you, and I said, "That's Bev." And you've never been to China, but you spent all that time in Vietnam covering the war. And I just have that moment in my mind. So tell us more, you know, tell me more about that. Some of the battles that you were on the ground in and the villages you went to, interviewing villagers and mountain people. And tell us about some of those events. You've mentioned to me before the 173rd Airborne.
Yes. Well, I got to Vietnam in 1962, and there wasn't much of a war there. The helicopters had just come in, and I was able to be a freelancer just with my camera and my portable typewriter. So I interviewed villagers. I went up to the highlands and interviewed people there. Went to one of the strategic hamlets they were building out of the jungle to pull the people in from the mountains. But then, of course, the war got more intense.
And what year was that, when the 173rd Airborne?
The Airborne came in the middle of 1965. It was the strategic reserve for the whole Pacific for the American forces, but they brought it into Vietnam, and they settled in the outskirts of Saigon. So in July of 1965, they were having their first offensive operation, and it was a historic one because it was the first time since the end of the China War that the Americans had ground troops in an offensive operation against an enemy.
Wow.
And it...
You'd already been there for a few years by that time. You went in... What was the first year?
I went there in 62, yes. So it was... This operation was really a first. It violated a fundamental principle of American foreign policy, never, ever, to have combat troops on the landmass of Asia again.
Wow, and you were there to witness and observe and write about it.
It was a tremendous experience. And it was so important that General Westmoreland, who was in command of all of the American forces, announced that he had been requested by the South Vietnamese government to have this operation with the American forces. It was the biggest helicopter operation of the war up to that time, about 120 helicopters, and it lifted 2,800 paratroopers into D Zone.
Wow.
This was a huge jungled communist stronghold covering six provinces, but only 30 miles from Saigon.
Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, you went in some of those helicopters. You also flew in and into battle zones. And you also walked in.
Yes.
Early your first year there, walking in. I remember the story in your book about the soldier in the lead who fell in a pit.
Yes.
And a stake went into his leg.
Yes.
And you witnessed all that. And I believe you learned something important. I always wondered, why weren't you scared? Were you scared going to these war zones? Where did that courage come from?
Well, on this operation, and the paratroopers were warned that 2,000 Viet Cong, that is the enemy, might be awaiting them. So the paratroopers were waiting together on the airstrip there, and a truck with rubber plantation workers drove by. And one of the GIs said to me, "He's making a fast count." Then he goes behind a bush and he calls Charlie. Charlie was a GI term for Victor Charlie, the communist enemy. And I said, the paratroopers at that point put his finger on a bewildering problem facing him and other GIs that followed on identifying friends from foes. After about a half an hour, the helicopter eases us down into the landing zone. It was a large plain filled with waist-high elephant grass that blocked the breezes and made for sweltering heat and very tough walking. The northernmost unit had already cut communist small arm fire and was returning with machine gun blasts. There were mix-ups, too. One group wandered around the defense perimeter. A sergeant was complaining, "We are the reconnaissance unit for the battalion. We are half of the ears, eyes, and nerves of a platoon. Now we are looking for the other half of the nerves and the platoon leaders." He wanders off to search in another direction. And the headquarters company of the battalion got lost in the jungle for hours. At nightfall, the radio operator reports, the headquarters company was still lost. A trooper amuses to me, "That headquarters company had better stay lost. I'd hate to be him if he's ever found."
Well, tell me, is that something that you reported on that for the Christian Science Monitor? Or was it
I wrote this in my story for the New York Herald Tribune, and fortunately I'd found a carbon of the story that I wrote. So I was recalling a lot of my interaction with the military voices that I encountered.
Oh, because I know that you were always very good record keeper, and
yeah,
you kept all your notes from decades and decades and decades ago.
And I was taking my own version of shorthand, too.
Yes, I remember you had that. Was any of that in here, too, in
yes.
your book?
Yes, I mentioned okay. some of this in the book. The troops were beating back the elephant grass as we marched, and a private chirps, "This is a real Hollywood war. So far, nothing serious has happened." Suddenly, a sniper bullet rings out. The trooper shuts up and cocks his weapon. Darkness settles in and brought rain as the units fanned out into their defensive position. Troops tied their ponchos to tree limbs to make a flimsy tent. Artillery shells bounced only 20 yards from the company lines, too close for comfort. At midnight, the Air Force dropped red flares to illuminate the whole area, and as a paratrooper explained, turning darkness into light. Before dawn, the whole unit was swimming in their ponchos and then packing up. They ate a cold sea ration breakfast of ham and eggs, or else juicy beefsteaks. At 9:15, the company was scheduled to be on the march, but the company commander announced, "We're going to be here a while." The headquarters company was still lost. A bemused private chortles, "This is just like a training exercise. But in a training exercise, we just go off and leave them. But we can't do that here." Then time for the company to march on again, suffocating elephant grass. The first sergeant barks, "Keep looking to the right and to the left. There's no sense going on like we own this jungle." A private whispers, "There ain't no tunnels here. There ain't nothing but jungle." By midday, it started to pour what the sergeant called cats, dogs, chickens, and everything else you want. While it poured, one soaked paratrooper confided to me, "This operation is part of the big war here. I can't see how it does much good. We should learn to send small 3 or 4 man units into the jungle and live there for months, like the British did in Malaya. But I don't think the generals are going to do that. They think of the big war." The paratrooper was astute, and in the end, the paratrooper's big sweep resulted in 1 American dead, 22 wounded, 1 guerrilla confirmed dead, and 17 wounded. 300 tons of rice were seized from their enemy, but it was in U.S. food surplus sacks. The operation was not only historic, but also prophetic. It was a microcosm of many search and destroy operations to follow that resulted in some resources, but few guerrillas.
Yeah, so you had told me, you've told me before that it was unproductive, in other words, that
it was an unproductive
people.
In terms that the communists were infiltrating troops and the army was determined to be, get the body count, to bring the body count down. But in this case, there were actually more American dead and wounded than there were the enemy for the paratroopers.
Yeah. Well, tell me, just going back a little bit, I've always wondered, how did a Nebraska farm girl end up in Vietnam? It wasn't a common choice for women in the late 50s and early 60s to fly to a place where you didn't speak the language, although I know you've told me you had French. You've studied some French, and so they were looking for somebody who had some French background and knowledge. So tell me about that.
Well, I think these kind of dreams start when you're very young. When I was in a country school where I went for 8 years, same school my father went to, I read the book, The Good Earth, by Pearl Buck. And it just completely fascinated me. I said, oh, I've got to see China and these other faraway places. You know, born in Nebraska, in the very heart of the United States, you knew there was a whole world all around you in every direction. I wanted to see this. And then I realized as I went along that maybe journalism was a vehicle for me to get to travel, not to be a travel writer, but to just understand other people and cultures. So that set me on the journey to Vietnam. I didn't go to Vietnam knowing very much about it. Most Americans didn't. We knew about the French Indochina War. I remember that in high school, but they didn't understand after 54, it was broken up into Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. So Vietnam as a distinct country wasn't a very real image for a lot of people. Anyhow, I just went there on a trip around the world, and I ended up in Saigon as the first American helicopters were coming in.
And then 1962,
right? 1962, February 1962. And I was freelancing. I had a master's in journalism, so I knew I wanted to write, and I was sending articles to AP News Features. But then...
You took a chance. You took your savings.
I took all of my savings.
You always wanted to be on adventures, so you went off on an adventure, and gosh, look where it's brought you. You've had these awards from Columbia University, from University of Nebraska, mm-hmm. from Hawaii, and we're still doing stuff together, right?
Yes.
You and me. We're working on a project right now on the Marshall Islands, and I'm hoping you're going to be with us if we eventually get down there after COVID, because you also did all that research on the bombing, on the nuclear tests done in the Marshall Islands. So you've had an interest in this whole region and holding the military accountable, basically, also, right? I mean, documenting, but mostly bearing witness to what happened. You've also mentioned to me Operation Starlight, and I wanted to find out more about that, these things that you witnessed on the ground as a woman and also talking to villagers. You came off the farm. So it seemed natural for you to just go to the villages, talk to the women, look at their food, look at their situation. I don't think the male reporters would go in and do that, and the women might not want to talk to them. I mean, I've seen pictures in your book, you with the Highlander women and with their babies. And all the girls around you, and who else could do that but Bev Kiever? So there were other female reporters, but you were the one who was there longer than anybody. And guys came and parachuted in and out and did some stories and left. And then the military officers would have to start all over with the next ones and train them, too, and teach them about what was going on. But you were kind of a go-to person. Too, but tell me about Operation Starlight with the tanks getting bogged down. You've kind of hinted at that, but I really don't know much about that operation.
The point is that the paratroopers operation was kind of unproductive, but when the communist enemy decided to stand and fight, then it was a bloody battle. And that I learned in six weeks after going out with the paratroopers, when I went out with the Marine units in the northern provinces. And it was August 65 on Operation Starlight that it was a land, sea, and air operation with a lot of equipment. Under the blistering sun, I walked with the Marine Patrol sent to recover the dead from hotel and India companies. They were part of the 5,000-man operation that had very little contact with the enemy, except for these two companies. The Marines from hotel company were heli-lifted into the landing zone and were almost immediately pinned down by heavy communist gunfire that hit all 18 helicopters that took them in. Coming to hotel company's rescue was India Company's amphibious personnel carriers called Amtraks. These are miniature tanks holding troops inside them. There are these 34-ton square boxes got bogged down in the squishy, squishy rice paddies. They received such withering fire that tank A-34 was demolished and abandoned by its crew. Other Amtraks soon became what one Marine called swimming coffins. Marines in both companies were pinned down for a day and night in a 1,000-yard ring of intense fighting near a communist-held hamlet, nestled amid hedgerows and soggy rice fields. An officer told me it was a natural tank trap, and we fell into it. A band of 30 Marines was encircled and shelled for more than an hour, more than 24 hours. A sergeant explained to me, it was like Indians in the Old West attacking a covered wagon convoy, except we were in armored wagons. He continues, I was in the invasion of Okinawa, and I've never seen anything like this. I thought this was the end of us all. Of the 17 tanks and Amtraks sent for relief, 10 became trapped, 2 were burnt out, and 3 became lost in the hedgerows for more than a day. My unit and I arrived at the helipad where the dead and wounded were being collected. There, a lance corporal told me the communists had taken over one abandoned Amtrak only 15 yards from him and played peek-and-boo with him all night. Sitting under his button-down hatch, he said, I took out my rosary and started praying. The dead being loaded up were encased in red dust. One died clutching a knife in his hand. Another had been disemboweled. One survivor, a young black private, watches and wails in horror. Tears stream down his cheeks, cutting a gully in the red clay caking his face. Later, our rescue unit moved into the communist-controlled hamlet. There, some of the bloodiest fighting had occurred. We moved past a dead pig, then a dead calf, then a dead woman next to a tunnel. Just beyond the first house, I saw something that stunned me even more. At first, I thought it was a carnival toy. It was puffed up and inflated like that. But it was a toddler, half naked, swollen from the heat, and swarming with flies.
Oh, Bev, that's awful.
Decades later, its pathetic little figure is still etched in my memory, evoking pangs of anguish and much, much regret.
Now, where was that published?
And that was Operation Starlight. In the end, the Marines claimed Operation Starlight a huge success, reminiscent of the World War II battles of Okinawa and Iwo Jima. News media echoed their triumph that 552 communists were killed and 1,000 wounded. The Marines sustained the heaviest number of casualties of any single action of the war up to that time, but restrictions on news cover required losses to be described as only light, so the American public was not really getting the full scope of the cost of the war in terms of bloodshed at that time.
So none of that information was being released to you either? Well, nothing at the press conferences or
well, yes,
public information officers?
No, they didn't tell us the American casualties. So that was the pivotal point where, you know, the key information about the American casualties was masked from the American public, but they were kind of overblowing the number of enemy killed and wounded.
Right. Wow.
Just a note that we have about 15 minutes left.
Okay, thank you. Well, so how did you get these dispatches out? Yeah, it must have been a challenge, too.
Well, we had various ways. At first, we had to go through the Vietnamese post office, which was slow and cumbersome and erratic, because during a coup d'etat or any political discussion, they seized the post office. Later, we found what we called pigeons, who carried our copy to the Philippines or Hong Kong and got it out. And then later they made arrangements with leased lines when the American combat troops came in to, like, file our copy through. We went through Reuters or later through the UPI.
Well, you typed it out teletype sometimes as well, right?
No, I typed it out in my typewriter and took it to the post office.
It on the plane. Yeah. Were the pigeons, were those people that would carry it out for you and film? I mean, the photographers too,
yes.
Right?
Now, do you want to look at Quezon?
Yeah, that's one I read a lot about in your book because it was considered to be a suicide mission to go there. And I actually heard that from my paddling coach who knew your husband. And he, you know, my paddling coach is a Marine and was also in Vietnam. And so when I mentioned your husband's name, and then he said, oh, yes, I knew Chuck Kiever. And we started talking about Quezon. And he said, oh, that was a suicide mission. Nobody wanted to go to Quezon. And he has, you know, he did talk about that with me. And so could you tell me actually more about the C-123 you flew in, right? I thought you'd gone in on a helicopter, but I went to your book and I was reading more details about that and that you actually flew in when it was extremely dangerous to fly in. And, you know, I saw a photo of a aircraft that was crashed. And, yeah, so Quezon, sad tale.
Quezon was much different than the Marine and the paratrooper operation, the ground operations. This was static. This was the Marines pinned in to it was a fort that the French had developed during the French Indochina War. And the Marines expanded it then, and the communists in January of 1968 laid siege to it. And that siege went on for 77 days. So actually kind of unsettling just even to get into Quezon because because I was waiting for the plane to take me there, C-123. I was waiting with a Korean journalist and Sean Flynn.
Oh yeah.
he was the son of the movie star, but he was later found missing in Cambodia, and I don't think they found his body yet. And an airman was alerting us that that Quezon was being mortared 300 to 400 times a day, and we can't do much about it, he said. In fact, a week earlier, communist units hit the base about every minute and a half. That was their record. So a shell was coming in. Some of these were coming, you know, high explosives. As we were waiting, a plane brought in the body of Robert Ellison. He was a 24-year-old photographer shooting for Newsweek. He had been killed at Quezon when the communists shut down the cargo plane he was riding in. I was particularly saddened because he and I had teamed up for a story only 10 months earlier. The crew chief was giving us an unsettling briefing. Be sure to buckle up tight, or you'll be swooshed out the back when we unload the cargo boxes of ammo and explosives. After the last cargo goes out, you have a split second to run out the back and head to the nearest bunker, because that's when the communists like to whoop in the explosives. During daytime, I hopscotched between bunkers to talk to the Marines. I heard heartrending stories of tragedy and death. Almost every Marine had escaped death from incoming shells for two or three times or seen a buddy killed. For example, there was Porky, an overweight corporal from Seattle, who strolled around his tent to deliver coffee and donuts to his supply unit. An Air Force cargo plane flies overhead to disgorge its bundles for Quezon. One parachute fails to open. scissoring Porky in half. His buddy laments, Porky was only 21 years old, and he had only 24 more days left in Khe Sanh. Then he was going to meet his wife in Honolulu. Then there was the top Air Force non-commissioned officer with his bloodied hand from a mortar fragment, racing for the medevac plane, only to be hit by another round twice in 2 hours. An Air Force officer tells me casually, everyone has a Hollywood view of death in Khe Sanh, but actually it's quick and simple here. A round comes in, 8 Americans are killed or wounded. Here the troops wear their boots, flak jackets, and helmets like extensions of their bodies, 24 hours a day. One Marine tells me he takes off his boots only once a month. They often adorn their flak jackets with their deepest sentiments. Birmingham, the magic city, says one, or I love mom and dad. Another says, God, send more flowers and less Marines, a thought, he told me, he copied from an advertising billboard in the land of the big PX, scribbled across the entire back of one flak jacket. A youngster had painted in black letters, life divided by time equals death every time. While Khe Sanh was still encircled and besieged, President Johnson announced he was recalling General Westmoreland to Washington. And 9 days later, the president announced he was halting most bombing of North Vietnam so as to begin peace talks, and he was not going to seek re-elections. The communists had achieved their political objective, but at the price of heavy casualties. The siege of Khe Sanh was then broken. So that's sort of what happened at Khe Sanh.
It was very hard to hear. It's very sad. Sad tales. And you were there in the bunkers with these men, and I just keep thinking, why weren't, you know, you must have been terrified, but at the same time, you knew you were there to bear witness and to document for the rest of us to understand what was going on. And you wrote that 3-part series and published it, right, in the Christian Science Monitor. You were nominated for a Pulitzer for that series. And again, you know, I think you were trying to tell me the other day, you never hear the shot that gets you. Tell me about that.
Well, yes. The reason I wasn't terrified at Khe Sanh was on the very first patrol that I went with. That was when I first got there in 1962. It was a night patrol with Rangers and American advisors, and I was ducking in the shadows, and there were sniper bullets off in the distance, and I was really scared there. And this one GI whispers to me, don't worry, you never hear the shot that gets you. So after that, I never worried about getting killed, because I realized that, you know, it was a war without a front line, and the danger could come from any direction in any way. I kept thinking of Dickie Chappelle, the first American woman killed in a combat operation. And she had been with the Marines in Okinawa and Iwo Jima and in World War II. But here in Vietnam, she was just out on a typical patrol and stepped on a landmine, and it got her. And the photographer who took the picture of her, an AP photographer, got the last photo, being given the rights, and he was killed a little bit later.
Helicopter, so, yeah, I remember.
So, you know, you could not predict what was going to happen, so you didn't worry about it.
Well, it's amazing. And so you left in what year was it that you left?
I left in January of 1969. President Nixon had just been elected but was not yet inaugurated. So that was a key turning point. And, you know, he kind of promised he was going to end the war. Well, he got a surprise. It took a lot more of that.
And why did you leave in 1969?
Well, I had met this wonderful Marine, and we went back to Nebraska to get married. And he was summoned to transfer, so I went with him.
To here, to Honolulu?
No, we went to Washington.
Oh, okay.
We went to Washington and then Newport and then Okinawa.
Oh.
And finally, we ended up in Honolulu.
Where you've been since and where I had the privilege to meet you when I got hired at the university.
Yeah,
as a
I
professor.
Started a second career, 29 years at the university teaching journalism and mass communication. And fortunately, one of my great colleagues was Ann Allman. She's always giving me fun adventures, and this is a great one here today. Thanks, Ann.
Well, thanks, Beth, for coming out and talking to me and taking some time.
I think
we have about 4 minutes for any additional questions, and we can close it here.
Do you want to talk at all about what lessons you would give to students? I mean, since we're both...
Well, I think my...
Lessons for students, Bev. What did you tell your students?
I would say
the classroom?
The important thing is for them to find their passion, something that they can put their whole life and their dreams into. And if they don't have one, and I think maybe many students are trying to find one, they have to find something that they think is within their talent range, what interests them, but also something that I think is going to make the world a little bit better, and then pursue that as much as they can and as do it as fast as they can, because life is very fleeting and fragile, and make the most of it.
And you've really been a model for that, and I'm looking forward to our next adventure later this year.